is a very busy man and has a lot on his plate. And to give us this time this morning is something really special, a special opportunity for us. Thank you so much, Ray.
You're welcome. It's a pleasure to be here. Okay, let's see what we could get to. So this here's a question. It just says here, cheating on English tests. It's an interesting question because apparently whoever asked this question is, I assume he's being, I'm not sure. Does he mean that cheating on the Midday College test for sure is okay, or cheating on the Midday College test for sure is not okay? I'm not sure which side he's coming from. But the issue with cheating on a test in general, whether it's English or the Mudei Kodesh, it happens to be it is an Isser. The Isser is called Gnevas Das. You are deceiving people in a meaningful way, whether it's achieving a grade, projecting to your self, to your parents, to the world that you achieved such and such a grade. So that happens to be that there is an Isser. But to me, that's not the biggest problem. It's funny to say that. It is very, you're doing a great deal of damage to yourself. And I'm not even getting involved whether you're learning the material properly. So let's accept the argument that your life will be just as good even if you didn't learn the material properly than if you did. But what you have done is you have developed a disregard for the Midah of Emes. And that is something that will afflict you if you don't correct it, your entire life. You will be a different kind of a person. Are you going to be the kind of person that somebody could trust and that you could trust others? Are you going to be a person that keeps your word? Are you going to be a person that is an Oved Hashem? You have to have a Midah of Emes. Rabbi Sol Salanter said that with all the Musar and all the Torah that a person learns, but if he's not Emesdik, he's going to be greatly restrained in his ability to serve Hashem properly. So it's something that people need to stay away. Like we kind of trivialize it sometimes. It's not a big deal. But it adds up and it creates a negative midah within us, which is not going to be so easy. It's been necessary to change and not so easy. So don't put yourself into that situation. Take the consequences or study one or the other. That's also a consequence, yeah. Is it right to pressure a friend to do something that he doesn't want to do if it's a good thing? For example, my friend has a great voice, but he won't sing. Should he be using his talents to daven musaf, etc.? It depends what you mean by pressure. You know, encourage is great. When you say the word pressure, you know, once you go over a certain line and you're making a person very uncomfortable, first of all, it could hurt your friendship, and it's really not right. You know, you're forcing a person come out to do something he doesn't want to. There are rare cases where it is acceptable, where it's a very, very, very important thing. And it depends also how you do the pressure. I'm sure you all know that I was here in Florida for many, many years, many, many years ago. My first year in Florida, I had a student in the ninth grade who was quite a bright boy, but as lazy as they come. And he was getting 80s, like in all his Gemara tests and stuff like that, which he could do in his sleep. And in fact, he did do in his sleep. And he wasn't really putting in any effort. But he was getting by and he was okay with that. You know, this. So I couldn't get through. I couldn't get any place with him. We had a ping pong table that guys used. And he had the shemua of being the best ping pong player in the ninth grade. In my youth, I was a pretty good ping pong player. So I once was watching them. I saw he wasn't really that good. So I was a little rusty. But I said, you know, I think I could beat him. So I made a deal with him. I said, listen, before every Gemara test, we're going to play ping pong. If you win, you get a 95 on the test. You don't have to take the test. But if I win, if you get anything below 90, it's a 60. You fail. So he said, okay, it's a deal. So we had the game before the test. The whole class was there. Some people were cheering for me. Some people were cheering for him. It was Leibedick. I beat him easily. He got like a 97 on the test. We did this every Gemara test. He's constantly getting into the upper 90s, but there's a problem. He kept on practicing, and I wasn't. I only played when I played the game. So the games are getting closer and closer and closer, and then finally he beat me. So I said, okay, a deal is a deal. You get a 95 of the test. I said, no, I want to take the test anyway. I'm going to get better than a 95. So that was pressure, but it was in a friendly way, and it was a very important thing. So you got to make sure you don't step on the line of making a person feel resentful and feel bad about himself. Here's a quickie. Why does Chafetz Chaim shave their beard if the Chafetz Chaim himself wrote about not shaving your beard? I'll tell you a little story I heard from a very reliable source. A bunch of fellows stopped by the yeshiva with a sefer. About half the sefer was about not shaving, and half the sefer was a different topic. And in the front of it, he had all these letters that looked like haskamas, you know, with letterheads and letters, 12 or 13 of them. I noticed one of them was from Moshe Feinstein. So I thought, that sounds a little bit strange, because I know Moshe was matir shaving, like, why would he write such a letter? So I look at the letter, it was not an haskama to the sefer, it was a tshuva that Moshe wrote about shaving, where he said that it's mutter. But they printed it under a letterhead. I started looking at the others, they were all tshuvas, they were not haskamas. So I said to the guy, what kind of business is that? You put all these letters at the beginning, make it look like haskamas. It doesn't say any place that they're haskamas. He said, why'd you put letterheads on it? So people should know who wrote them. So they weren't haskamas. So I said, forget it. You know, like, so I called somebody new who was close to Moshe. Did Moshe know about this? He said, yeah. It was the only time I saw Moshe throw somebody out of his office. The guy came and asked for haskama on the sefer. And he said, look, you know, I don't agree with it. I'm not going to give you haskamas. They said, well, Chafetz Chaim wrote in some of his forum, you know, that you're not allowed to shave. He says, the yeshiva in Radin, everybody shaves. That's because they didn't listen to the Chafetz Chaim. He says, okay, but so-and-so, I don't remember the name, was the Chafetz Chaim's personal shamish, and he shaved. So he said, that's because he covered his face every time he went to the Chafetz Chaim, so he didn't know that he shaved. At that point, he threw him out of the room. Come on, give me a break. So there are contradictions, really, in the Shita. But the mice in Europe, they did. It was very common, yeshivas did shave. Even today, most yeshivas, the Bachrim, shave. Right? A lot of times, the Yungalite, when they're married, they grow beards. So that's the reason. This is a good philosophical question, but I don't think we could deal with it here. Okay. Why does Hashem bring tzaras to people who don't deserve it, or at least in our view, don't deserve it? How is it possible to not question the process and the plan of HaKadosh Baruch Hu? This question, it goes back. Do you know how far this question goes back? You know, the first record we have of somebody asking this question was Moshe Rabbeinu. The Gemara in Brachos says that Moshe Rabbeinu asked the question, you know, Rasha v'tov lo tzadik v'ra lo. So there's actually, the Gemara gives two answers. The second answer is, very often a tzadik is not a tzadik gomer. He has certain chatoim he did, and Kadosh Baruch Hu wants to punish him for his chatoim in this world, so he doesn't have to deal with it in the next world. And a Rasha very often has done some good deeds, so Hashem rewards him for the deeds in this world. You may have heard that answer in the next world. But people conveniently skipped the first answer. The first answer was Hashem didn't answer him. He said, V'chanosi es asher achon, v'richanti es asher achem. It's my business, not your business. You'll never understand it. It is a challenge to Emunah. Particularly sometimes when things like that, chas v'shalom, but it does happen, sometimes they strike home. And it is a challenge to Emunah. And HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we do have to have, in a general sense, the understanding that this world is only one step in the process. Right? Olam HaZeh Don the Prozdor, there's an Olam Haba. In the end of the day, we will understand why everything is really good. But in this world, with our limited vision, our limited sight, it's a challenge. You know, I heard a vort many, many years ago from Rav Shaya Kohn. And this was at the shloshim of his, I think it was 6 or 7 years old, son who had died. His name was Aryeh. So if you want to know where the name Zichron Aryeh and there Aryeh and so it comes from, that's where it comes from. And he spoke at the shloshim. So it was a very emotional moment. And he quoted the pasuk that says, "V'rega katana zavtich, v'rachem gedolim akabtzeich, num Hashem." I left you for a moment, rega katon, rachem gedolim akabtzeich, will I gather you with great rachamim. I got to ask you a question. Don't answer, because I don't want to put anybody on the spot. When was the Beis HaMikdash destroyed? It's close to 2,000 years ago. And we still haven't been rescued. Rega katon azavtich. I left you for one moment. 2,000 years is one moment. But you know what happens sometimes in life? Sometimes in life something takes place and it drags and it drags and it drags and it takes much longer than we wanted. But then you reach the finish line and everything works out. And when you look back at it, it was no big deal. It was so worth it. It was so worth it that all the time you put into it, it's nothing. See, that's what's going to happen. When we see the plan of Hashem with its clarity, it is so worth it that we will be laughing at ourselves. Why would we be so upset? Rega katon azavtich. What was the big deal? But when you're in it, it ain't no rega katon. It's really, really difficult. But that's the answer. I was once sitting in, by invitation, and it intrude, a meeting. I think I could say the name. I think I could say the name, but it's a name that is a little bit meaningful around here. A woman, her name was Mrs. Zissel Klerman. You might have noticed the Sam and Zissel Klerman name if you hang out around Torah Emes and Torah Chaim. So they were major benefactors of the yeshiva, and they helped to get the campus in for the elementary school, and they helped with this building. Just about the time that we bought the campus for the elementary school, Sam Klerman suddenly passed away. He was not such an old man, maybe 60 years old or so, I don't know exactly, but not such an old man, maybe in his 60s. He passed away suddenly, and she had many other difficulties in her life. She herself was a Holocaust survivor, and they went through some very hard times and different other kinds of tzaras. And she was a little bit down, or more than a little bit down. She wanted to meet with her yeshiva, and we were present for that meeting. And she said to the Rosh Yeshiva, "Am I such a bad person? Am I such a bad person that Kadosh Baruch Hu does all these things to me?" And she started enumerating all different tzaras that she went through. And the Rosh Yeshiva said, looked her in the eye and said, "There's only one way to find out the answer to that question. Are you ready?" What did he mean? You go up to Shemayim. It's the only way to find out the answer. Are you ready? She looks at him and says, "No, not yet." But that's the answer. We don't know the answer to these questions. But we see enough Yad Hashem in this world, in our lives, and we take a historical perspective, and we know that HaKadosh Baruch Hu has a plan. And sometimes we see it. I'll share with you a little Hashgacha Pratis story, not that big a deal, but it's an interesting story. How did I get here yesterday? There was a follow-up with the tickets. It was supposed to have a tickets on a flight, and the travel agent messed up, whatever it was. I had no tickets. There was one flight they said there were tickets on. There was a 12 o'clock flight, JetBlue flight, leaving 12 o'clock, that there was you could get tickets for. I said, "That's very nice, but I have to give share. I can't leave before share. My wife is teaching. We can't get out at 12 o'clock. So what happened? The 12 o'clock flight got delayed. First they said it was 2:30. I said 2:30 could work. We got tickets, then it was 3:15, then it was 3:45, we ended up leaving at 4 o'clock, it was perfect. So there was a lot of people on that flight that were very upset that the flight was delayed. I was very happy. Maybe Hashem delayed the flight so I could talk to you guys, I don't know. But maybe it's one of the cheshvanos anyway. But sometimes you see the Yad Hashem, many times we don't. So the answer is, V'chanos yes asher achon, v'chamti yes asher achem. HaKadosh Baruch Hu has his cheshvanos, And it really ultimately will be good. Sometimes we see the good, and sometimes we don't see the good. I'll tell you another, this is a story I often tell, maybe I even said it here, but it has to do with this campus, the Torah Emes campus, the Torah Emes Torah Chaim. At that time we didn't own any Well, no, maybe, I don't remember the exact time, but Torres Emes, let's say, was in rented quarters in the Shul Miami Beach, and they were outgrowing the space. We weren't quite ready to undertake a major building campaign, but we knew it was on the horizon a couple of years down the road. This building came up for sale, this campus. It was a conservative shul, and they were going to sell it to a church, and people were tumulting. And they said, listen, if we match the church's offer of $1.2 million, they'll sell it to us. One little problem we had. We were approximately $1.2 million short. Okay, so what do we do? So there was a famous philanthropist, I don't know if you ever heard the name, Joseph and Faye Tenenbaum. If you travel enough in Eretz Yisrael, you'll see their names on many buildings, in Toronto as well. And they were older people at the time, and they were starting to spend the winters in Florida. And somehow we hooked up with them. And Rabbi Yachnis remembers the story, I'm sure. We hooked up with them. They came to visit the school. They came to visit the school. And they were very impressed. Said, why don't we try Joseph Aitam and see if they'll help us. So we called him. We got him on the phone. We asked him if he would give us $1 million to help us buy this building, and we put the name on the building. So he said, you know what? Come see me in my office tomorrow. He's in Toronto. And bring your plans. So, one little problem, we didn't have any plans. So we called up the architect who had done the original Torres Chaim building and asked him if he could draw an architect sketch like in 6 hours. We need it for tomorrow morning, and we'll pay him for that. And if we do buy the building, he'll get the job for the renovations and so on. I said, fine. He did it. I stayed up till whatever time in the morning, putting together projections, all stuff, speculating. Three of us went to Toronto. Rabbi Yachnis, who was the one who made the introduction, and Rabbi Chait and myself. We almost didn't make it out of the airport. In those days, when you traveled to Canada by car, you didn't need a passport. But apparently when you travel by plane, you did, and we didn't have our passports. But I guess the agent didn't want to see three grown men cry in the airport. He let us through anyway. We go to Mr. Tenenbaum's office. He's sitting there with his assistant. And by the way, these are international tickets at the last minute. It costs over $1,000 a ticket. We spend over $3,000 on this trip. But it's worth it for $1 million. We come to the guy's office, and his assistant said, Joe, you can't do this, Joe. You know, that building you have on Yonge Street, you're losing $6 million on that building. There's another building you have to walk away from, and you just spent $12 million on the shul. You still owe money to Or Sameach. You can't do it, Joe. So he looks at us and says, I'm sorry, and he hands us a check for $500 Canadian. Doesn't begin to pay for the ticket. So we walk out of his office, and we say, what's going on? Now we're in Toronto with nothing to do. So we decide we'll try to see Reichman. They're a big, rich family in Toronto. You can't just walk in on a family like that, a person like that without an appointment, you know? So we didn't get to see him, but they did let us speak to his tzedakah secretary. So we walk into this tzedakah secretary's office. He had a bookcase, floor to ceiling, clearly all the kind of stuff you get in the mail. You know, all these forms with the, you know, that's where they collected the whole bookcase full. And on his desk was a little set of shas, you know, four volume set of shas. So Rabbi Yachnis had one of the great lines all the time. He said, he looks at the bookcase and then he looks at the shas. It looks like Ravina and Ravashi have been here too, raising money. He didn't even smile, the guy. Like, we're not getting any place. So he takes out all the information, all right. So meantime, we lost money on the trip. Then we got $3,600 check from the Reichman, so at least it covered the trip, and we made a few $100. At the time, we were devastated. We thought we had it in the bag. When he told us on the phone to come see him, that was a yes. Right? He's not telling us to come to say no. Right? Say no, it's much easier on the phone. So we really had, we were already, had the, you know, had the money in the bank. We were counting on it. It was devastating. But you know what? If we would have bought that building, it would have been the biggest disaster. We did not anticipate how fast Torres Emes was growing. And we would have outgrown the campus in 3 or 4 years. And then what? You can't make another bully campaign 3 years later. We ended up getting the Torah Seventh campus that you're familiar with, which is much larger, and that worked. And then we got this campus for Torah Chaim. So in the long run, it all worked out. But at the time, it looked so terrible. So sometimes you see Hashem's plan. Most of the time, we don't. But it's always there. All right, let's move on. Why do high schoolers lose their personality when they move into the Beis Medrash? I don't know what Beis Medrash you've been hanging out. I don't know. I guys have a lot of personality. Maybe they get a little more serious. That's not the same thing as losing your personality. It's a good thing to get more serious. Although, I don't know. People say to ask me, you know, when I'm going to grow up, but... A couple of questions I see on smartphones and smart devices, which is always good to talk about. It was here a number of years ago that somebody sent in a question, why do the Rabbeim hack so much about the internet, and why don't they talk about something really important like Lashon Hara? Does anybody here remember that? I think it was a number of years ago. So I said, you know what? I'm going to talk about Lashon Hara. Many years ago, when a person wanted to tell Lashon Hara to somebody, he had to find a friend that he could talk to and tell Lashon Hara. What if he couldn't find his friend? He couldn't tell the Lashon Hara. Sutton wasn't very happy with that. It's so limiting. So Sutton thought for a long time, and you know what he did? He invented the telephone. So now, even if your friend isn't there, you could call him up on the telephone and you could tell Lashon Hara. It's great, Gevaldik. After a while, the Sutton still wasn't so happy. It's true, you could call your friend and tell him, what if he's not home? Right? What if somebody else is on the phone and the line's busy? You know, so a lot of times you don't get through. So he said, this just isn't doing it. We got to upgrade it a little bit more. So he invented the cell phone. So now everyone could have their own phone. Even if he's not home, you could reach him. Gevaldik, I could tell him Lashon Hara. For a while, the Sutton was happy. But you know how the Sultan is. He's never satisfied with what he has. Halavai, we should learn from the Sultan. We never be satisfied with what we have. We should always strive for more. So he goes on to say, you know, it's not bad, but you know, sometimes the guy doesn't answer the phone. He's busy with something else, or he himself is on the phone with somebody else. The pain. Sometimes I think of a nice, juicy piece of Lashon Hara, but it's late at night, and I feel funny calling him so late at night. So the Sultan was thinking and thinking and thinking, and he said, I got an idea. He invented texting. So now, even if the guy doesn't answer the phone, you can text him. It's late at night, you can text him. He'll see it in the morning. If he's up, he'll call you back or text you back. Ah, it's great, texting. But the son wasn't satisfied with that either. He said, texting is good. Yeah, it's not bad. But you only text like one person at a time. That's not so good. So he invented the internet, social media, WhatsApp, things like that. And then, this way, you could tell Lashon Hara to so many people all at once. And then so many different people could respond. If you have a WhatsApp group and you tell Lashon Hara, you know, if you only have one guy, he might not think of something to tell you back in return. But if you have 20 people in the group, somebody's going to think of something. So Baruch Hashem, he could keep the Lashon Hara going on and on and on. On social media, when I said this, Donald Trump was still president of the United States. So I said, well, Donald Trump wants to tell Lashon Hara. He puts it on Twitter, and he can tell 12 million people at once. Now, I don't know if the Sultan's happy now. I hope so, because if it gets worse than this, I don't know what we're going to do. The internet is an extraordinarily useful tool, but an extraordinarily dangerous one. And to have a smartphone where you have access all the time, now they're coming up with different types of, you know, kosher phones that are very restricted, and some of them might be acceptable, but to have that constant access, constant interactions, it opens the door to so many things. And even more than that, it becomes, the non-Jewish world has begun to recognize this also. It becomes, it makes a significant impact on the person themselves. They are living on their phones. They're not living their lives. They don't have the same relationships with other people. They don't have the same ability to focus and to learn. The National Institute of Health allocated $1.something billion in 2019, right before COVID, 2019, to study they call it screen time, because it's not just smartphones. It's smartphones, computers, other devices, tablets, whatever. Screen time on development of people, because they saw problems. They saw correlation between depression and screen time, suicides and screen time, dysfunctionality and screen. Nothing to do with religion, nothing to do with Lashon Hara, nothing to do with Shemir Seinayim, nothing to do with anything. They don't care about any of those things. But push it. So it is, when we first started our policy in Queens, I didn't shut off the sound. That's me. This guy's not an easy guy to say no to, but. when we made the policy, no smartphones in the yeshiva in Queens, there was a guy who, we took a while, we hacked Chofetz Chaim style, we hacked it through, we talked back and forth, and we did it. So one guy came out, he appreciated the fact that, he was listened to, but he says, it really makes his life so difficult. But I'm going to do it, but it makes life so difficult. He says, really, why? I need the internet. He says, why do you need the internet? Because I do a lot of traveling. And it's very hard to get airplane tickets, these days. Okay, how often do you travel? He says, 6 times a year. Okay, fine. What else? I have a special dietary supplement I need to take, and the only place you could get it is on the internet. I said, okay. How often do you order that? Once a month. Okay. What else? Didn't really have an answer. So I said, so you're telling me that you need internet for 18 minutes a year, and because of that, you're going to carry around a smartphone 24/6? You know very well that those 18 times that you need the internet, you'll find a way to get access. But I'll tell you what, if you do have a problem, please come to me and I'll let you into the office. I'll let you use the office computer and you'll be able to get your stuff done. People don't even realize, do they really, really need it? It becomes a thing. So it's a challenge. It's probably the biggest challenge we face today's generation, but it isn't. Again, I don't know the specific policies here in Miami. I don't want to get myself into too much trouble, but our basic mantra is kol ha-memayit harei zeh meshubach. The less you do, the better it is. And we don't, there is a very interesting study. I saw somebody show me this article. I had it posted on the bulletin board in Queens. The University of California at San Diego, not exactly what you would call a right-wing reactionary group, right? Pretty liberal college. They did a study. What they did was they gave people material to study, and then they tested them on them. They had, equal groups. And one group, they asked them to put their cell phone in a locker and move into a different room and take the test. The other group, keep the cell phone in your pocket or in your purse, and go to a different take the test. And the third group, keep it on the table in front of you. They duplicated this several times. Every single time, the group that had the cell phone in the locker scored the highest. Cell phone in the pocket was next. Cell phone on the table was the lowest. And they asked them, were you distracted by your cell phone? They all said no. Nobody was conscious of being distracted by their cell phone. And all of them thought they weren't distracted. Yet, look at the results. The last time they did it, they also did it together with a questionnaire. And in the questionnaire, they were trying to find out how much people used their phones in the first place. And the more they used their phones, the greater was the distraction. So it affects so many areas of our lives. That was not a smartphone, by the way. Okay. What is the proper way to pursue an education post high school? I guess this is mostly immediately Nogea seniors, but it's Nogea all of you eventually. The first thing I say, he says education, so I'm not sure what he means by that. He means secular education, Jewish education. But I think if you want to go through life being an Erlich Yid and keeping up your values, you need to be in yeshiva after high school. You know, that's a given. Nobody could face the nisyonos of the world today without a solid background and a solid foundation in learning. And even if you're going to end up going into business or professions or doing something else, and in many ways, it's fair to say that if you go into a secular profession, it's even more important that you learn yeshiva for as long as you possibly can. And actually, I remember a fellow telling me that he came to the yeshiva in Queens and he felt that Harbatzis Torah was not for him and he's going to go into business or whatever. So he figured he'd learn yeshiva 2 or 3 years and then whatever, get some degree and move on with life. He was at an Oneg Shabbos at Rabbi Harris's house, and Rabbi Harris made this point that if you're going to be working in the secular world, you need to have foundation in Torah. So maybe it's more of a reason to stay in the yeshiva. So it struck him, and he talked to stay in the yeshiva many years. He got smicha, and I don't want to tell you too much more. I don't have permission to give away his identity, but he kind of found a way to bridge the gap between working on a business and helping our Bessus Torah. Very interesting outcomes. But the fact of the matter is that that it's important to have that background in Torah. Now, in terms of whether or not a person should also do college or whatever it might be, training in other jobs, careers, I think that's a decision that has to be made on a case-by-case basis. But I don't think it's a decision that has to be made right away. I think the first few years out of high school, a person should try to devote himself. What's your rush? You don't need to hurry into that world. Devote yourself to learning, and then you figure it out. But we believe sometimes there is a place for secular education post high school, but not everybody has to do it. Some people maybe should, but I think the most important thing is to make sure you're learning. Now, how do you figure out where you should be, where you should go to learn? Again, that's a highly personal type of decision. And, you know, it depends on your tchunos and your interests and your desires. And, you know, probably it's good to check out things if you're interested. I will say something, which I wasn't paid to say, but I'll do it anyway. Maybe I'll get payment afterwards. Baruch Hashem, you have a very wonderful matzav right here. And sometimes people fall into the trap of saying the grass is greener. Go someplace else. Because everyone knows, you know, the downsides of what you're familiar with. You don't know the downsides of what you're not so familiar with. So the grass is greener on the other side of the hill. Sometimes you find out later the grass wasn't necessarily greener. You know, so if things are working, like what do they say? If it ain't broke, don't fix it. So if things are working, it's very kedai to think seriously about continuing where you are. But ultimately, you know, there's a lot of personal feelings and concepts that go into it, so it's pretty hard to give a generic or general answer. But the generic answer is you got to be in learning, and in terms of the secular, you make your decisions where to learn. You got to figure it out. In Queens, we have a unique situation in our 12th grade, because Queens does not really have a base management program for people straight out of high school, so everybody in Queens is going to go someplace else. So it's open season. All our branches recruit in Queens. Kind of horror, Baruch Hashem, we have quite a few of them. And it makes them crazy. They get here for this one, that one, the other one. They've made the rules to try to limit the time, you know, this. So one time, one of the fathers of one of these boys called me and said, complain my son crazy. And I, well, you have to find some system. It's crazy. So I said, I don't know. I don't really have a solution, but let me tell you something. It's a good thing for a guy, at least one time in his life, he should feel wanted. But the, so he wasn't happy with that answer, though. But, okay, here's an interesting saying. I have personally not heard this saying before, but it's cute. I've been told that when you daven, you are speaking to Hashem, and when you learn, Hashem is speaking to you. What does this mean? Why specifically learning? Truthfully, I don't think it's specifically learning. Hashem speaks to us in many ways. We don't always hear the message. But you know what? When I made that flight yesterday, Hashem was speaking to me. Hashem was telling me, I haven't forgotten about you, and you should know that this trip to Florida is important. And you shouldn't think that, you know, it's such a tircha, it's such a schlep, I have so many things on my inbox, you know, like, come back, I leave a voice on my message, I'm not taking any messages till Monday, but when Monday comes, you know, there's going to be a pile. So Hashem sent him, he was talking. But I think what that means is, and if it doesn't, I'll say it anyway. I don't know. I can't speak for the people who coined the expression, but it has a ring to it. When you are learning, what is Torah? Torah is HaKadosh Baruch Hu's das. It's HaKadosh Baruch Hu's communication to mankind. When you learn Torah, you are connecting and hearing what HaKadosh Baruch Hu says. So that sense, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is communicating, man, is something much more than that. When you learn Torah, it affects the way you think. You become a greater thinker. You think more like HaKadosh Baruch Hu does, as much as a human being can achieve that. I will tell you a little story. I don't know if it's scientifically compelling, but I believe it. I have a brother who is a well-known immigration attorney, but what's not known is that he spent a year in graduate school learning psychology. He had at one point had a machshava of becoming a psychologist after he was learning in yeshiva for a number of years, by the way. But he one of the things he had to do for one of his courses is to practice administering a test that was called the Wechsler Adult Intelligence Scale. That test requires more than 2 hours to administer it, and it tests all different kinds of aspects of your perceptions and thinking and so on. And apparently it was used, at least then, as a diagnostic tool, because people do have strengths and weaknesses in different areas, but they're usually within a range. But if there's a very great difference, sometimes it's a clue to something going on psychologically. It takes 2 hours to administer the test. So how do you get some guy who's going to sit with you for 2 hours just so you could practice administering this test? So you go to your brother. So I said, okay. So I took the test. So when the results came in, they presented to the class, of course, without any names. This is in Brooklyn College Graduate School. So I scored substantially higher on what they call the cognitive skills, which is the thinking ability, than the perception, which I could have told you that without the test. And there was a very large gap. So somebody in the class is saying, oh, is that a sign that this person has emotional problems? So I'm not saying that I don't have emotional problems, but the professor said, wait a minute, was this one of those Talmudic students? So my brother said, yes. Oh, I get that all the time. They always score much higher on their cognitive section than on the others. I think these Talmudic studies just develops their cognitive abilities. So this is what he noticed casually by being in Brooklyn College Graduate School. So a person who learns Torah thinks differently, thinks better, thinks at a higher level, because why? HaKadosh Baruch Hu is training him to think. He understands HaKadosh Baruch Hu's perspective to a very, very limited extent. But the more you know Torah, the more you know what HaKadosh Baruch Hu thinks. So learning Torah means HaKadosh Baruch Hu is speaking to us. So even though I never heard this expression before, I think there's a lot of merit to it. Not to exclude that there's no other avenues of communication. But learning Torah is an avenue of communication that's very meaningful, and very accessible. Okay, I'm being told time is up, but so that means I didn't get to all the questions. So that means you have to invite me back. And Bez Hashem, you shall have atzlacha, bracha. Hear a Kadosh Baruch Hu speech. Steig, you're learning, and you will see. You'll grow. It's hard, by the way, to see our growth, because it's incremental. It goes little by little, day by day. I always compare it to the difference between my mother and my aunt. When I was growing up, we lived in Montreal, and every summer we drove to New York to meet with, you know, vacation, meet with Mishpacha, and I have this aunt who I only would see every summer, and every time I saw her, I was a little kid. My, how you've grown! You've gotten so big! I hated that. I don't know why, but it always bothered me. My mother never said that. One day my mother said, you know what? Your pants are too short. You must have grown. How come she didn't know that I grew? Because you see them every day. It's incremental. They grow. My aunt saw me once a year. Sometimes you should look back at yourself. How was I a year ago? How was I 2 years ago? And you'll see that you've grown. And if you continue that way, you continue to grow, Bez Hashem, you'll reach Hatzlacha and Bracha.
Are you ready to do another round? Huh?
Process is that the spirit is not in the front.
Come over. Then I'll walk you back home. Surely we'll walk back home from your house.
Can I have change for a month?
Yeah, 1 minute.